Hello. My name is Leroy Chatfield, director of the Farm Worker Movement Documentation Project, which is located on the internet at www.farmworkermovement.us. Today is Wednesday, March 11th, 2009, and this is another in a series of oral history interviews entitled, Who Was Jim Drake? Our interview guests today are Margaret Murphy and Jeff Sweetman, both of whom worked with Jim Drake in Mississippi in the early 1980s. This interview will be published in the oral history section of the Documentation Project website, farmworkermovement.us. Before we begin the interview, I would like to welcome our guests, Margaret Murphy and Jeff Sweetman, and ask each of them in turn to give us their name, where they live, and tell us a little bit about who they are and what they do. Margaret, let us begin with you.
Okay, my name is Margaret Murphy. I was a United Farm Worker volunteer in the 1970s for 6 years, worked with the National Farm Workers Health Group, primarily directing some of the farm worker clinics. After I left United Farm Workers, I worked for the California Conservation Corps for a couple years, and then in 1980 was married to Jeff Sweetman, and the two of us moved to work with Jim Drake, who had been an organizer, early organizer with the United Farm Workers, but who had moved to Mississippi and was organizing pulpwood haulers. We were we lived in the South for 10 years, and then in 1990 moved to Milwaukee. And for the past 15 years, I have been working as an RN case manager in public housing in Milwaukee. Have two grown children.
Thank you, Margaret. And Jeff, what about you?
Well, I also worked on the staff of the United Farm Workers from 1975 to 1978. Originally in the LA area grape, lettuce, and Gala wine boycott that the UFW was conducting. And it was that was during the summer and fall of 1975, which was where I first became acquainted with Jim Drake. For the rest of my time with the UFW, I was in a kind of, I guess we called ourselves legal workers, probably would be called paralegals now, in the UFW's legal department. After that, I worked for about a year and a half with the California Conservation Corps, and as Margaret said, we got married in 1980, and at that time moved to Mississippi to work with Jim Drake's woodcutter project. We stayed in Mississippi after that, and I went to law school at University of Mississippi, Ole Miss. From there, we moved to Atlanta, where I practiced law for 6 years, and in 1990, we moved up here to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where I've been practicing ever since. And as
Thank
Margaret's,
you.
Yeah.
Now, to begin the interview, who was Jim Drake? Let me direct this question to each of our guests. When and under what circumstances did you meet Jim Drake, and what were your first impressions? Again, Margaret, let us begin with you.
Well, actually, while I was working with the United Farm Workers, I never worked directly with Jim Drake. I actually knew him more by reputation as one of the original organizers. I was in Phoenix, Arizona during Cesar Chavez Fast in 1972. Jim was also there leading the recall drive, but I never worked directly with him. In 1975, he also was part of the organizing drive in Calexico, and I spent a few months in December 75 through early 1976. Again, never worked directly with him. So actually my experience in Mississippi was the first time that I worked directly with him. My first impressions, just by reputation and seeing him, was that he obviously had phenomenal organizing skills and seemed to just be very successful in any of the organizing that he did. Again, I didn't know him personally.
Okay. And Jeff, what about you?
Well, as I said earlier, I first became acquainted with him when I joined the UFW staff on the Los Angeles boycott in the summer of 95. He was, at the time, the director of that entire operation, which covered not only Los Angeles, but the San Fernando Valley, East Los Angeles, the western part of Los Angeles County around Santa Monica and Venice and those areas, the southern part of the county, such as Long Beach and San Pedro, and I believe also the smaller cities inland in the southeastern part of the county. And that operation, as I recall, had probably, you know, upwards of 60 or 70 organizers, maybe more, and all of us were working on a budget of $5 a week plus, well, basically $5 a week. The poster that I had responded to, which had said, come and help Cesar Chavez and the farm workers save their union, talked about $5 a week and room and board. Found out that the room was find a supporter who would take you under their roof, and board was go out and get food stamps. but Jim was a, my first impression of him was that he was a very imposing presence. And I mean, physically, he was a big man. And not only a big man, but one who sported a huge walrus-sized mustache, and you know, and just extremely dedicated, extremely focused, and extremely capable in this matter of organizing, which at that point was something that I knew virtually nothing about. But also, you know, a very approachable individual. I did not really get to know him at the time, partly because he was there for only perhaps a month or a little bit longer after I started. UFW was moving into other areas of emphasis at that time, because California had just adopted legislation that that for the first time in history gave farm workers the right to vote in secret ballot elections to elect their own union representatives. And Jim was reassigned to work in one of the areas in the Central Valley My recollection is that he was sent to Stockton with some of the other key leaders of the L.A. boycott to start organizing farm workers in that area for the elections that were going to start in September of 75.
Okay. Now, just if I understand this correctly, and to recap, each of you worked with the United Farm Workers, and then after that, each of you worked with the California Conservation Corps, and then you got married. Now, explain to us how and why you made your way to Mississippi to work with Jim Drake.
Yeah, go ahead.
Actually, I was working near Santa Cruz with the Conservation Corps, and I'm not sure who told me about a house meeting that they were having in the East Bay. One of the former UFW volunteers, and I don't remember who it was. Jeff was in Salinas at that time, still with the United Farm Workers, and it was a house meeting which Jim Drake was going to talk about his project in Mississippi. And the two of us drove up to that. And that piqued my interest. And after that meeting, I started corresponding with Jim. As we started looking at, you know, getting married and where we were going to live, we made the decision to check out the organizing project in Mississippi and visited that in the summer of 1979.
Well, what did you learn at this house meeting that piqued your interest?
Well, I had, prior to moving from Iowa to California, I had dabbled at the idea of going to Mississippi. I had gone there to meet a priest who was organizing in Hattiesburg. And I opted at that point not to go, and instead wound up moving to Arizona and then on to California. But when we went to this house meeting, for me, I guess it was having some of that same interest stirred up again, and I don't remember the specifics of the meeting. I just remember that Jim had that same kind of passion that I had seen within the United Farm Workers, and I was looking for something that was going to make a difference in people's lives.
Mm-hmm. And Jeff, what do you recall about that house meeting?
Again, my recollections of the meeting are quite sketchy. It struck me as the same kind of house meeting format that we had been trained in, in fact, by Jim when I was with the L.A. boycott. And the same format and the same, you know, building up to a pitch for support and money and, you know, what a terrific cause it was. And, you know, beyond that, I don't remember all of these specifics, and anything that I probably would remember from it would be probably influenced by my memories of what we actually dealt with once we got there in Mississippi.
Uh-huh. Do you remember approximately how many people came to the house meeting?
It was not a huge group. I seem to remember maybe, I don't know, 10?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
10.
Yeah.
Did anyone else from this house meeting that Jim was conducting Did anyone else from that House meeting find their way to Mississippi to work with Jim?
No. Ken was Ken. He had already recruited Ken Fujimoto, and we went with Nancy Kleiber.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember any of the other people there, but no, there weren't any other people there.
Okay. All right. Well, let's now.
Yeah, I was going to add just that Ken Fujimoto had worked very closely with Jim on the Los Angeles boycott and was his successor as L.A. boycott director after Jim was sent up into the Central Valley.
Okay. Well, let's move on to Mississippi. Tell us what was the project that Jim was doing in Mississippi and explain it to us.
Jeff, why don't you go?
Jim was an ordained minister of the United Church of Christ, the old Congregational Church. And as one of the stories he told me after we got to Mississippi was that he had actually been raised and went to seminary as a Presbyterian, but the Presbyterian Church required their recent seminary grads to go into ministry in particular churches, and that really was not what Jim was looking to do. He wanted some sort of alternative ministry, so he switched to the UCC and told me that his two alternative options at that time were either a job as chaplain at Sequoia National Park or the National Farm Worker Ministry, working with Chris Hartmeyer, Reverend Chris Hartmeyer, and this new organizing project that had been set up by Cesar Chavez with farm workers, and this would have been way back in the early 60s. But at any rate, when Jim left the UFW, which I believe was sometime in 1977, he was contacted by John Moyer, who was the director of the UCC's Board of Homeland Missions, which had provided substantial support to the National Farm Worker Ministry. And John Moyer asked Jim to go down to Mississippi to see what was going on with a group that was called the Gulf Coast Pulpwood Association. And this was had been a grassroots organization of pulpwood cutters who had organized a strike back in the early 70s against some of the paper companies. And the Board of Homeland Missions had begun sending them some annual contributions, and so John wanted to find out how well that money was being spent. And Jim went down there to, and I believe the fellow who headed up that Gulf Coast Pulpwood Association was a woodcutter named Fred Walters, who lived somewhere near either Laurel or Hattiesburg, which would have been in the southeastern part of Mississippi. And so all the money was going to Fred Walters, and Jim had to report back to John that it did not appear to him that much of the money was actually being used to organize pulpwood cutters. And Jim, or rather John Moore, then asked Jim Drake, well, how about if you stay down there, see if you can start organizing pulpwood cutters. After all, you've had, 16, 17 years of experience organizing farm workers. And if you can get something going down there, we'll send the money to you rather than to Fred Walters. So Jim agreed to stay down there and see what he could do. The pulpwood cutters, by the way, these were men, by and large all men, who would go out into the woods in Mississippi. Now, you know, people who aren't from down there may have different notions of what Mississippi is like. Margaret's mom, for example, thought that it was one great big cotton plantation from one end to the next. I thought it was a big swamp, kind of like the Louisiana bayous. But really, and there are huge cotton plantations in parts of Mississippi. There are swamps in other parts. But in most of the state is covered with forests, particularly pine forests. And you can drive for miles and miles and miles and see nothing but woods all around you. And pulpwood cutters were these men who would go into the woods and cut down pulpwood. They'd cut trees and then saw them into logs that were a little bit longer than 5 feet, and stacked them up on the back of pulpwood trucks. Take those truckloads to wood yards that contracted with paper companies to provide them with the pulpwood that the paper companies would then take and grind into the pulp, which is the first step toward making paper. The work is extremely hard. It's backbreaking. It's dangerous. You're out there in the woods by yourself with maybe a couple of helpers. You're sawing down trees could fall on you or one of your helpers. You're driving an old rickety truck that was not built for pulpwood hauling, but was basically reconfigured as a pulpwood truck many years after it had completed its useful life for which it had been originally intended. You had a boom on the back of your truck that you used to kind of haul the wood up onto the truck bed and onto the stack. If you were lucky in a day's work, you might get four or five cords on the back of your truck. Then, assuming that you were all still in one piece and your truck could make it, you drove your haul to the wood yard, to the wood dealer. Now, you were at all times considered an independent contractor. You were not considered an employee of this wood yard dealer. Your helpers were your employees, but you yourself were an independent contractor. Even though the only real assets that you may own are your chainsaw and that truck. When you get to the wood yard, the way they normally determined how much wood you had was the dealer would come up, hold a long measuring stick up against your load, then look up into the sky, more or less in the direction of the top of the stick, and tell you, well, you've got 3 quarts. And you know from all the years that you've been doing this that you've got 4.5 quarts. And you're paid by the cord. And the dealer says, no, you got 3 cords, and that's all I'm going to pay you for. And then he may tell you, and if you're not satisfied with what I'm telling you, you can go somewhere else. See if another dealer will pay you more for this load. But if you do, well, you know, you owe me for the truck. You owe me for the saw. You owe me for all the chain oil and supplies that I've been furnishing you to go out there and cut that wood for me. And if you do go to the other fella at the other end of town, I'm afraid I'm just going to have to call in all your debts. So in other words, you're stuck, and you take his money for the 3 cords. And by the way, out of your take, he deducts a fee that's called stumpage fee, and that's the amount that he sends to the landowner, the fellow who owned the land where you cut the wood, because he also is paid on the basis of how many cords you're credited for. So those are the people that Jim was going to try to organize.
There hundreds of people like this?
At the time, there were all over the state. Except in areas like the Delta, where there just isn't any timber. But in just about every other part of the state, you had pulpwood cutters. And you had, the paper companies are big down there. You had Weyerhaeuser, you had International Paper, you had Georgia Pacific, you had St. Regis. All of them have huge operations. All of them had pulp mills down there in Mississippi.
Now, are these workers black workers, white workers?
At least 90% were black. Mm-hmm. There were a few pockets of white woodcutters, but by the vast majority of them were black. None of them were in any way wealthy. Most of them were poor, and the rest were, somewhere where they could, some of them had decent homes, decent houses with a little bit of land. In fact, most of them, because these were all all of them lived out in the country. I mean, we're not talking about people who lived in cities and towns, but these are people who lived out in the country. And most of them had enough land where they could at least raise a garden. One of the fellows that we've stayed in touch with since then, a fellow named Willie Lee Little, He lives in a town called Mashulaville, which is on the near the Alabama line, and he had enough land that he could raise corn or whatever, and he had a team of mules that would pull his plow for him. And this was back in the 1980s. Almost everybody else had converted to tractors and.
Right. Well, focusing a minute on the pulpwood worker.
Yeah.
A hard day's work would yield. What do you think, Jeff? Do you remember?
Oh, in terms of money?
In terms of money, yeah.
Yeah. I believe at that time the going rate for a cord of wood was about $30.
So if you got paid for three cords, even though you had four and a half, you're $90, not counting paying your helpers and not counting your deduction.
That's right. That's right.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So you'd net maybe 25 once they took out the stumpage.
Right. Margaret, let me direct a question to you.
Can I just add something on that?
Sure. Please do.
One other thing that with that group of workers also is that they were not all the same. I mean, there were people who worked other jobs who might cut wood on Saturdays. There were people who maybe would cut a couple during the week, and that was, in terms of organizing them, that was something we always had to keep in mind. It wasn't like for every one of them that it was full-time employment. And so in terms of what issues they organized around, you had to be sensitive to that.
I guess
the other thing is they also, there were those who had been in Mississippi their entire lives. There were also people, and some of them were some of the strongest members, were people who had gone up north to work and had worked in Chicago or Michigan or Ohio or whatever, and had worked maybe for 15 or 20 years, had been members of unions there and come back. So it really was a very diverse group of people who were cutting wood.
Okay. Well,
one other point, I had mentioned earlier that the dealers insisted that these fellows were independent contractors. One of the things that Jim and the rest of us went in there thinking was that we needed to change that arrangement. We needed to make these guys employees. And that way, well, first of all, that way you could, get them to organize a union. But also it would provide them, we thought, with more protections. But, what we found out was that there really was not an awful lot of sentiment among them for becoming employees. A lot of them liked being independent contractors because it meant that you get to set your own hours. You don't have somebody telling you you're going to be here starting at 8 o'clock and you're going to work until 5:30. You go out there whenever you want to. If you want to spend the full day in the woods cutting wood, that's your choice. On the other hand, If you just had a good steady rain and the creek is up and there are lots of good fishing, go and do that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Margaret. Let's get to focus on Jim Drake and what was his organizing strategy, if that's the word, or what? How did he go about trying to organize these pulpwood workers? From your point of view, what you saw?
Well, we came in April of 1980, and they had already been organizing for a while. There were already a couple other staff there. So they actually had their approach was really a house meeting type of organizing, frequently in people's homes, sometimes in churches. Most of the black workers were very active in their churches. Sometimes they were the minister. And so there was never, we were never at a loss for a place to meet. And whatever our particular job was when we went to Mississippi, all of us spent sometimes organizing in the evenings. And again, because they had already sought out ideas from workers, the credit union had already been started prior to our coming there. And actually, Jim used, he moved in and, had a seemed to have a really good sense and a network of finding out where stuff had been done. I mean, the credit union actually was modeled after a one that was done in Carthage, very near the final office for the woodcutters in Thomastown. And that was started by a Catholic priest, Matt Fogarty, who had basically organized a community credit union. And so he was one of Jim's contacts. They were already finding out that there were issues around, I mean, as Jeff was saying, these woodcutters were in debt to the fellas at the yards. So we knew that oil and chains for the chainsaw were something that they were going to, they would be interested in if they could save money and if they were not going to be dependent on that. So they had already started soliciting ideas. And I guess, again, I'm not sure exactly at what point all of this happened, but obviously the issue of the way they measured the wood became a very dicey with people. And, I mean, they talked about being short-sticked, so cheated. And that became really the eventual campaign and the thing that, a year later would lead all of us to Jackson and trying to get legislation passed. So, I mean, I think Jim has a really good, had a very good sense of listening to people. And I think, again, because some of those communities knew each other and because they were, many of them were connected with each other, once you made an inroad, you could count on people showing up for meetings. There were some natural communities there.
Did you have meetings every night?
Usually not, but we went out several evenings a week, primarily to try and connect with people to set up meetings. So the meetings, they were not every night, but we went out a few evenings a week.
Was there generally speaking, a meeting once a week?
I don't remember that they were that frequent.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Well, certainly you were making contacts or
right.
You may not have, at any one time, you may not have been having house meetings every evening of the week or even every week, but you were in contact with woodcutters at various levels on a daily basis.
What about, did Jim Drake have a central office where people came? You talked about a credit union, starting a credit union and starting a little co-op for chainsaw oil and chains. How was that handled? Was that in a centralized place, or explain that to me?
Well, when we arrived in 1980, they had already moved from Lexington, Mississippi, to Thomastown, in which they had purchased this house, and it was a two-bedroom house, had a huge porch, front porch, which later served for storage of all of the oil and chainsaws. It was where Jim and Chris lived. Actually, we lived there when we first moved there. That's where the stuff was delivered, and then in bulk, and then it was broken up and delivered to other areas throughout the state. But that's, I mean, the front porch was full of boxes of oil and chains for the chainsaws. That's also where our office was. We had no computers at that time that I can remember. A lot of it was done on index cards. And it was kind of the center of all of the activity. A couple of the other people that were organizing lived about a mile away, and then we had a few other people living in other areas of the state. But the center was right there in what was called the Lacey House. It had belonged to a doctor many years before that. Had a huge yard, had a area that Jim gardened. Mm-hmm. Did a lot of gardening, and that was really the center of the operation.
Gardening for himself and his family, or?
Yes.
Yeah. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, he used to go out early in the morning. The South in the summer is pretty oppressive. I mean, the summer we moved there, the above 100-degree temperatures started in April, and there were some into October. I mean, it's oppressive heat and a lot of humidity. So if you're going to do any work in the garden, you do it early before you get the middle of the day.
Or if you're going to cut wood, I guess you get started early.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm. The front porch that Margaret mentioned was screened in.
Yes.
So,
yep. But nothing was locked.
No, nothing was locked.
No. And I don't remember that there was ever a problem with anybody taking anything.
Uh-huh. And the credit union was located there?
Yes.
Yep. Yeah.
And who ran the credit union?
A woman named Kate Bronfenbrenner was the credit union manager. But the credit union board was made up of woodcutters or woodcutters' wives. And the organization effort, the official name of the overall project was called the Southern Woodcutters Assistance Project. The organization of the woodcutters themselves was called the United Woodcutters Association. Then you had the United Woodcutters Co-op, and you had the United Woodcutters Federal Credit Union. And of all of those, the one that is still operating is that credit union. It has been expanded into a community credit union serving primarily East Central Mississippi. But that community credit union is had its origins with the woodcutters and the Jim's Southern Woodcutters Assistance Project back in 1979 and 1980. Mm-hmm. Those folks are still, you know, there, and that's what those folks still brag about. That's, you know, it may be a community credit union, but it's still theirs. And
now, when you both of you really were from the North, and going into the South, the civil rights movement had taken place in the 60s, bringing about the right of blacks to vote, mm-hmm. Civil Rights Act, Voting Civil Rights Act. What did you find discrimination there, or to what extent, or how can you give us some examples of what you saw that brought you up short, so to speak?
I'm not
sure. We saw some of both, actually, right?
What's that?
We saw some of both.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, a lot of it was stories that we heard of things that had happened in years before. For example, the Catholic Church that Margaret talked about in Carthage, which was about 15 miles from Thomastown. The priest where when we arrived there was Father Matt Fogarty, the same fellow who helped set up that community credit union in Carthage. When he first arrived there, and I think he said it was around 1966, their church was not in town, but it was way out in the woods, and it was this old, little church building way off the road in the woods, and next to it was a kind of corrugated tin building that served as the school. Well, there were both black and white Catholics in Leak County. Both came to that church. I believe the church was St. Anne's.
Yes.
The whites would worship in the church. The blacks had to worship in the school. They were not allowed in the church. And one night, some night riders came by and torched the school. So the only building left standing was the church. And at that point, Father Matt said, well, this is crazy. I'm not going to offer two masses, I'm not going to keep offering two masses, one for whites, one for blacks. We're all going to worship together at the same mass. And he apparently got very little resistance. The only problem was that they figured out very quickly that the old church building was not big enough to accommodate the entire parish, and so they built a new building in town. Mm-hmm. In Thomastown itself, as everywhere in Mississippi, the schools had been completely segregated. And one of the last efforts of the segregationists had been to start building newer schools for the black kids, so that they could say that, in fact, separate but equal really worked. And so Thomastown built a brand new school building for the black kids. They had been, going to school in a shack, and there was a much better building where the white kids went, but now the town was building a brand new building for the black kids. The only problem was it was located on top of a swamp. That didn't bother the good city or town leadership, Benny, that the blacks were going to have to go to school in a swamp. They were going to have a nice building, and what more do they have to complain about? But once the courts made it very clear that separate but equal was not going to work anymore, and that the white kids and the black kids would all have to go to the same schools, first item on the agenda was, now we got to drain the swamp, because now white kids are going to be going to this school as well as black kids, and we don't want our white kids having to go to a school in a swamp.
Now, what year are you talking about? What period of time?
Well, that would have been in the early That would have been in the early 70s.
Early 70s, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Now,
what about Jim Drake? Did he suffer any discrimination because of his work or because of his association with the workers?
Well, when he started the project, after John Moyer gave him his marching orders, he originally settled in Lexington, Mississippi, which is, you know, about 75 miles north of Jackson. It's Lexington is in Holmes County, which is right on the edge between the Delta and the Hill Country. And there are a lot of blacks in Holmes County. And the whites maintained the same sort of feudal social order there that pretty well predominated down in the Delta. So you had the black section of town in Lexington was referred to by both blacks and whites as Balance Do.
Balance Do?
Balance Do, because everybody who lived there had a balance do owing to one or another of the white merchants down around the courthouse square.
Mm-hmm.
There was paraplegic, I think he may have been a vet, living in Lexington, named MacArthur Hibbler. And he organized a boycott among the blacks, a boycott of all the white businesses. And so the white folks there hated Mac Hibbler. There were also three or four Catholic Franciscan nuns who were from Minnesota, who were living in a house in Lexington, and they were also supporters of the boycott. So when Jim moved to Lexington with Ken Fujimoto and Chris Drake, or Chris Woods at the time, they rented a house from an old fellow named Lacey. Lacey was also the name of the doctor whose house they finally bought in Thomastown, but this was Mr. Lacey of Lexington, who told Jim when he moved in, he said something like, "You look like you're all right. Just want to give you a warning. I don't want you bringing any trash around this house." And Jim said, "Fine, I won't bring any trash in the house." Well, when Margaret and I visited the project in the summer of 79, that's where they were living, was in the house in Lexington that they were renting from this Mr. Lacey. Apparently, shortly after our visit, Jim asked Mac Hibbler and the nuns if they would like to come over for dinner. And they said, and they did. The next day, old man Lacey came by the house and he told Jim, "You know, I told you I didn't want you bringing trash around this house. And I'm going to have to ask you to leave." So he evicted him. And after they were evicted, they sent out a call to supporters. And, you know, we'd been to that house meeting, so we'd visited them in the summer, and so we were on their mailing list, and their newsletter announced that they'd just been evicted, and they needed massive financial help finding some place where they can move to. They obtained funds from a Franciscan community in, I want to say, around Santa Barbara, California. Funds sufficient to purchase the Dr. Lacey house in Thomastown. And so that's how they ended up in Thomastown. They then went ahead and sued Mr. Lacey for evicting them. They filed in federal court under the federal fair housing laws. The case was assigned to Judge Harold Cox, who was one of these, one of several real bad segregationist judges that John Kennedy appointed to the federal bench. And Kennedy apparently thought that he could ingratiate himself with Senator Jim Eastland of Mississippi, who by then was the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee. And I'm not sure that that the ingratiating went more than one way. But even while we were there, Cox had a standing order that when he was in the elevator at the building that served as both post office and courthouse in Jackson, no black person was to be allowed on the same elevator. Jim and Chris and Ken were all represented by the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights under law. The case was tried to Judge Cox. Margaret and I went and watched it. It was a one-day trial. At one point, one of their witnesses was a Vista worker who had who was also from up north, and a woman who had gone down to Lexington to teach at one of the schools, and Lacey had evicted her after she had asked a couple of the black employees at the school to help her move her belongings into the house, and he evicted her, telling her that he didn't like the idea of her rubbing N-word elbows. At any rate, Judge Cox ruled that yes, Lacey had evicted Jim and the others because they had invited a black guest, but he decided that the fair housing law did not prohibit what Lacey had done, because it only protected tenants from being evicted because of their own race, not because of the race of their guests. Now, fortunately, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals set Judge Cox straight on that, and since Judge Cox had already found that the real reason that Lacey had evicted them was because they'd had a black guest, he had no choice but to decide the case in their favor after it came back from the Fifth Circuit.
That's a very clear example of what Jim Drake and you all had to go through to try to organize poor people.
Well, history in Mississippi is never very far below the surface. One of the locals that they organized fairly early on was a group of white woodcutters in a town, little hamlet called House. And this is located about halfway between Philadelphia and Meridian, Mississippi. And Philadelphia, of course, was where the three civil rights workers, Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney, were murdered in 1964.
Mm-hmm.
The organizer that happened on this group of woodcutters in House was a fellow named Tom Israel, whose sister, Martha, whom we knew as Muffin, had worked for the farm workers. And Jim had, I guess she had given Jim his name, and Jim went up recruiting at Brown University, and Tom Israel and another student named Peter Goldberger answered the call and came down as student organizers for that summer of 79. And Tom found this group of white woodcutters in House, and they were thrilled. They told him, you know, this is the first time anybody's come by wanting to do something for us since the Klan left. They didn't hold anything against Tom, even though he was Jewish. And things went along very well until the United Woodcutters Association announced its first annual convention was going to be held in Philadelphia. And these fellas got in their truck from House, drove up to the community center in Philadelphia where everybody was gathering, and saw, to their horror, that everybody else there was black. And they just said, you know, that Jim Drake had done them dirty, because he hadn't told them that this was going to be another use of the N-word outfit, and got in their truck and hightailed back to House, and we never heard from them again. It turned out I was, sitting in the office there in Thomastown one day, and I'd been reading a book about the murders, and I was looking through some of the old membership lists, and I came upon the list of that House local, and right at the top was a fellow named Edgar Ray Killen. Well, Edgar Ray Killen is the same guy who was convicted within the last two or three years, finally, of his participation in the lynch mob that murdered those three guys.
Hmm.
This that was an incredible story in and of itself, because he was the first member of that lynch mob to be tried and convicted in a Mississippi state court for that
mm-hmm.
crime.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there he was, right there on the on our membership list.
Uh-huh.
So, like I said, you go down to Mississippi and you're going to, feel history come very close to you.
Uh-huh. Margaret, I would like to, our time is running, and I would like to focus on how long that you and Jeff stayed working with Jim Drake in Mississippi, and you're leaving there, and some reflection about your work and Jim's work there. Can you tackle that for me?
Sure. And I guess one comment I would just like to make, the material that Jeff just laid out also is one side of Mississippi. I mean, one of the things that I was struck with about Jim was that, I mean, they lived in this very small community, and actually it was pretty much non-eventful. I mean, he went to the store, he went to the post office, we all went there. We never had comments made. I never felt really unwelcome. I mean, I obviously knew that we were outsiders. We were Yankees. On the other hand is Jim was just, if you didn't know Jim was from outside Mississippi, you would not be able to pick that up from his demeanor. We had, when we arrived, I mean, we had some just very delightful experiences. When we first arrived, they had started a festival about 20 or 25 miles north of Thomastown in Kosciuszko. And one of the things they had was a 10K. And Jim trained for that. He was, the first time he ran was when we arrived. And it was like the week or two after we arrived. And Jim is a big guy. And so he did the whole run. And he told us that as he came to the end of it, he looked at one of the people there who was clapping as he came through, and he said to one of the fellas, "Am I walking or running?" And the man looked at him and said, "You know what? I can't tell." He actually was very, very comfortable in that setting. I think the pace was something he liked. He was very kind of slow-speaking, very consistent, solid. I mean, didn't do a lot of, you know, yelling or any of the rest of it. He's just a very, very solid fellow. And I think that's why he had the kind of response that he did from woodcutters, is that it wasn't a lot of cheerleading. It wasn't that sort of thing. He was just very, very, very solid. Mm-hmm. So actually the experience, and that kind of set the tone, I think, for Jeff and I, is that we actually felt very good about having started our marriage there and living there, and we still feel very connected. I mean, we go back there periodically to visit. Jim was, one of the things that I remember about him was when some of our money came from grants that were written, and supposedly that was a job that he wanted me to do, although actually by the time we got there, he had actually written a lot of the grants. But we had visits from some of the foundations that had given us money, a Campaign for Human Development and some of the other groups. And I remember feeling kind of uptight when they called and said that they wanted to come and do a visit. And actually, Jim was just kind of not affected by that at all. He just said, "Let's take him out and let him meet some of the woodcutters." Actually, we didn't have to say anything. And because there was so little going on in Mississippi and so few requests for grants, Campaign for Human Development, which is, you know, one of the arms of the Catholic Church, usually only does a grant for 1 year, sometimes two. They funded that project with the woodcutters for several years, and it was because they really felt good about what we were doing. Mm-hmm. Jim was a really, he was easy. I remember going to the post office one time, and one of our co-workers had some letter that came, and the return address was USSR. And I picked it up, and I thought, why would someone do that? Living in Mississippi, knowing what kind of, you know, we're outsiders, they're going to think we're commies, you know, go through the whole thing. And I just kind of mentioned it to Jim when I came back. He just said, "You know what, they're going to get us kicked out of Mississippi." But nothing. He didn't have a need to, we were actually very diverse politically and ideologically. And he was actually very comfortable with that. He didn't get into a lot of small stuff. For me, he always kind of saw the big picture. We stayed the spring, I guess early summer of 81, and Jeff had applied to Ole Miss Law School. I guess we left in the summer, actually,
yes.
In June or July.
Yeah.
And then we wound up spending another 3 years. And we did see Jim and Chris periodically. We went to a couple of the conventions afterwards.
Do you remember hearing when Jim left Mississippi?
He left sometime in 82. His crowning achievement with the woodcutters was the enactment of state legislation in 1982 to basically rein in that practice of short sticking that we had talked about earlier. That was, from day one of the key issues that the woodcutters said they needed something done about. And so when Margaret and I got down there in April of 1980, the first thing Jim told me to do was figure out what the law is on pulpwood cutting and figure out what we need to do as far as new legislation. So I would take trips down to Jackson, to the state law library, and to meet with the Department of Weights and Measures, whose desk was right next to the Egg Inspection Department. When I first went down there, everything was closed because it was Confederate Memorial Day. The next time I went down there, Weights and Measures was out getting himself a sandwich, and Egg Inspection invited me to sit while he ate his lunch and told me what the difference between a Yankee and a damn Yankee is. The one comes to visit and the other comes to stay. I kind of cobbled together what looked like legislation, the kind of document that would pass as a bill in the Mississippi legislature. A lot of it I took from setting up an independent agency to regulate the whole thing. I borrowed a lot from the Agricultural Labor and Relations Act that had been adopted for farm workers in California back in 1975. And when I handed it to Jim, he just looked at it and he said, "Wow." And he was, all of a sudden, here was his, this dream of his on paper. We organized the second annual convention of the woodcutters was to get the organization formally behind adoption of this legislation. And woodcutters came from all over the state, driving up in those rickety old pulpwood trucks. And afterwards, they served what they called a magnificent feast, and it was just like the old barbacoas that the farm workers would have at their fiestas. The woodcutters had so much respect for Jim. they would always and only refer to him as Reverend Drake. And particularly for such a, you know, church going community, that was a huge sign of respect. After that, the next step was organizing what Jim called accountability nights, getting all the woodcutters in a particular county to a meeting at a church or community hall, and not just invite, but demand that their local state legislators attend, and then basically put the legislators in the hot seat, ask them, are you going to support this legislation or not? And a lot of legislators did say yes. Now, a lot of them later went back on their word. But there were others. In fact, the one from Kosciuszko, where we live, who came to this accountability night meeting with two other legislators, and he just assumed that most of the woodcutters were going to be from the other guy's districts. He got up and he asked, how many of you are from Kosciuszko, from my district? Half the crowd raised their hand, and from that point on, he was our most faithful ally in the legislature. So you had these accountability nights building up to the legislative session, which in Mississippi basically occurs during the first 3 months of the year.
And this legislation passed?
Well, we went down for a rally in Jackson that, and this would have been in, it was in either January or February of 81. And, then we all went in and watched while this one committee was holding hearings. It did get through a couple of the committees. And the committee chairman for this one, for this hearing, was in their state senate, was a fellow named Joe Blunt, who had attended the accountability night down in his area and had pledged to support it. But after that, he, you know, the paper companies and the wood yards told him, don't let it pass. And the Speaker of the House, Buddy Newman, had also made it clear that he didn't want this thing passed either. So Joe Blunt understood that his role now was to kill it in committee. And we sat there for hours watching them go through all sorts of other pieces of legislation in an obvious stall tactic. And then finally Joe Blunt called this up for consideration, and he said, "Now, as far as I'm concerned, this thing is just a product of outside agitators coming in, trying to whip up our, the woodcutters who really didn't have any complaints until these outside agitators came in." So that was the end of it for that year. And we had been told by a number of other folks who lobbied in Jackson on behalf of progressive causes that that you would be lucky if legislation that you pushed for introduction 1 year would get passed within the next 5 years. Well, that wasn't good enough for Jim. And so over the next year, they, Jim and the association had contact with landowners, you know, the same the people that were paid the stumpage. And these landowners began realizing that, wait a minute, if woodcutters are getting cheated with this short stick at the yards, so are we. And so, the next legislative session rolled around in 1982. Not only was the United Woodcutters pushing it, as they had the year before, so was the Mississippi Farm Bureau. Speaking on behalf of all the landowners. And this time, the word was, something's got to pass this year. What they did was they took out all of the stuff that I put in there about setting up a new agency a la Agricultural Labor Relations Board. But all the stuff that we put in about what the woodyards could and could not do stayed in exactly as we'd written it.
That's an amazing accomplishment.
It was totally amazing.
Yeah. And what a boon that must have been for the workers.
Oh yeah. Now, the pulp woodcutters, we talked to Willie Lee Little just this last summer. He was up visiting his son here in Milwaukee. He said, pulpwood cutting is gone now. They're just not doing it anymore. All of the cutting now is long logs. But at that time and place, Jim, mm-hmm. Jim really made a difference for an awful lot of people.
Boy, he sure did.
Who really respected him and are still, Willie Lee still talks about him in very, almost reverential tones.
With that, I'm going to have to bring the interview to a close because we've run out of time. But I want to thank Margaret Murphy and Jeff Sweetland for this most interesting interview about Jim Drake and his work in Mississippi. And with that, I would like to say thank you, and we will close the interview. Goodbye.
Okay.
Goodbye.